Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, July 29th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, sitting in for Amy Simons. Joining me for a radio-only edition of Views this week are Missouri School of Journalism Professor Ernest Perry and Stacey Wolfel, director of the Murray Center for Documentary Journalism. On our agenda this week, it wasn't a great week for one of our great news organizations. The New York Times has had to deal with controversies around two of their recent exclusives, one involving Hillary Clinton's private email server and another dealing with working conditions at nail salons. Just 1 week and 1 day before the first of the Republican presidential debates from Cleveland, lower-tier candidates are scrambling. Fox News is loosening the requirements for taking part, and pundits are pondering just how much it all matters. The new employment numbers are out for American newspapers, radio, and TV, and they're sobering in terms of raw numbers and in the lack of progress on newsroom diversity. News organizations are flocking to a new source of revenue, meanwhile, a movement that's raising renewed concerns about ethics. First on our list this week, the New York Times had the story all to itself for a bit. Relying on what editors described as multiple high-level government sources, the paper reported that inspectors general for two federal agencies were asking the Justice Department to conduct a criminal investigation into whether Hillary Clinton had mishandled government information on her now infamous private email server. A blockbuster story, to be sure, only some of the details were apparently wrong. The investigators didn't actually point a finger at Mrs. Clinton herself. Regardless of what they may have told the Times and other news organizations, the word criminal did not appear in their actual referral to the Justice Department, and though they found emails on Clinton's server that they described as classified, the information was not labeled that way in the emails themselves. Compounding all this, the Times was slow to correct online versions of the story or explain why they walked parts of it back. Well, Ernest, that's a lot to get wrong on such an important story.
Yeah, I think it all boils down to, and even the public editor for the New York Times said this, it all boils down to a lack of transparency and a lack of understanding, not only say understanding, but use of anonymous sources. Again, we fall into this trap of using anonymous sources, not doing thorough checking, not making sure that we have the right information, and then to compound it, we aren't transparent about our transgressions. So
we'll talk a little bit about the defense that the Times makes in a minute, Stacey, but no matter how you parse it, that's a black eye.
Oh, it really is, and I think to compound it even more, there was a rush to print here because they were worried about somebody else getting the story, and I think the reporters and editors involved were smart enough to understand the facts of the story if they had taken just a little bit more time to figure it out.
Well, let's parse all of this in a little bit more detail. So the Times put out a defense, at least as found in an editor's note to the public, and this is basically what they said. We relied on sources who confirmed the original story more than once, not only to us, but to other news organizations, and that we were too slow in correcting the record. So we're sorry about that. Is that a good enough apology or explanation?
Well, no, I think you're going to have to go a little bit more in depth. And if you go back and you read the public editor's response in her investigation of it, what you find out is that the Times reporters didn't actually look at the complaint. They got it from a source who said that they had looked at the complaint. You also find out later on that they should have dug a little bit deeper to find out, was it a Justice Department source or was it a congressional source or, you know, that sort of thing. And in this highly charged political environment, especially involving Hillary Clinton, you have got to have all your ducks in a row.
But, you know, I mean, Stacey, on stories big and small, and TV news has dealt with this for a long time, there's always going to be this criticism. If you just took a little more time to do the reporting, then you'd get it right. But it's pretty hard in today's environment to take that extra time.
It is. I spent many, many years as news director at KOMU, and you're always worried that at 6 o'clock, at 10 o'clock, what will everybody else have versus what we has, what we had. Our hope was that we still got it right, and we worked pretty hard on that. But the pressure is more than it ever was before. You know, and if there's a silver lining to this, it's interesting that there's an expectation in the public that when you make a correction, that there be a lot of transparency to it. And the public said there wasn't enough. And so if anything good has come of all this, we know that news organizations will be held accountable if they're not transparent with the corrections that they make.
Yeah, say a bit more about that, Ernest, because, I mean, back in the olden days, I mean, there were rarely corrections, and if they hardly ever on air, and if it was in the newspaper, buried inside somewhere. Now we're not only talking about did you make a correction, but did you make it fast enough, and did you make it obvious, and did you put out another version of the story?
And I think that those are all the things that come with the heightened sense of you've got to get it right. And if you don't get it right, then you have to be transparent, not only about, okay, this is what we didn't have in the story that we should have had in the story, but this is also how we put the story together. And that's the key right now, is that people not only want to know what was wrong with the story, they also want to know, how did you get it wrong, and what are you going to do to make it right?
Right. One of the readers really laid out a blueprint that any news organization, he called for, demanded really, an annotated version of the original story to go through and say, what did you change? Why did you change it? And frankly, the Times could have done exactly that and would have put off a lot of its critics.
And the other point here is that not only is the public looking for it, for that kind of due diligence, but you also, your competition is going to use that against you. And that's the thing that I think the New York Times seems to be, they're worried about their public, but they're also worried about, what is our competition going to say about what we've done? And that gets down, you know, goes down a slippery slope that you're never going to placate that side of the aisle.
No,
it's the public you need to be worried about.
They're in the enviable position of being the largest target for the right, the largest target for the public in many cases, and the largest target for other media.
And regardless of how this story was received and whether you defend any of the Times practices, obviously it's a big deal because of the potential impact. I mean, here's the Clinton campaign and her sympathizers in the media worrying about whether or not this is going to reinforce that narrative that you can't trust her. And in fact, there were a couple of polls out this past week that show on measures like trust and favorability that she's kind of underwater in some of these key states.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where she, you know, going into this, she had to deal with that trust factor. And then when you have a story that comes out like this, it's the first story that people see. And not everyone is going to go back and read all of the mea culpas by the New York Times and here's how we went about it and here's what happened and how we got to this. They're going to just read that first part about the fact that her emails were kept secret and that there's this investigation and that going on. And then you've got the partisan media out there and the partisan media blogs that are going to stick with that narrative, the first narrative, the one that had the holes in it, had the problems. So, I mean, it does create problems for her, and now she's going to have to sort of fight that battle.
Well, now, you know, we have been, and I think rightfully so, pounding on the Times a little bit for their behavior. But I thought Howard Kurtz, who's the media critic over at Fox News, and he actually reported on the Justice Department for the Washington Post back in the day, had a kind of an interesting take. And I want to see what you think about this. He said, I can tell that bureaucratic language is mainly semantics. When an inspector general refers a matter to justice, it's saying, we are a civil agency. We have no power to prosecute. But we think this could potentially rise to a criminal matter, and we leave it to you to make that judgment. The wording doesn't really matter. Is that a kind of fair defense of the overall journalism of this piece or the relevance of it?
I don't think that it is. That's Kurtz's take on this. Other journalists and other watchers of Washington might take that a little bit differently. But if you think that's part of the story, then report that part of the story. Go out and find somebody other than your media columnist who will say, this is how this usually happens, and you can back that up with cases.
Yeah. And when you do that, I think we need to begin to start going back to, if, I mean, we've always used anonymous sources, but I think when we're talking about stories like this, we're going to have to start naming sources, because this is one of the areas where we get burned over and over and over again, is by using these anonymous sources and not really having enough justification for doing so.
The print media may end up in a spot where they get where television has been, that people have never trusted a hidden source on television because it's a shadowed figure, their voice is distorted, and it's always put this air of, why won't this person show his or her face? Mm-hmm. And I think the print media are now getting into that same spot.
Well, this wasn't the only story to get the New York Times in hot water the past week. The paper's top editors actually wrote more words defending their recent exclusive series about terrible working conditions in New York area nail salons. And those stories, as some of you may recall, I think we talked about it once on the show, Ernest, they purported to show rampant wage theft among essentially, you know, what are indentured servants for the migrant workforce that works at these nail salons. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo thought enough of the story that he ordered an investigation. Later, he signed law that would try to protect these nail salon employees. So before we get into the criticisms, I'd have to say, you know, that's the kind of impact that most journalists live for.
Yeah, I mean, that story talked not only about the nail salons in New York, but it also has led to investigations of that industry as a whole across the country. So it is an impactful story. But what I do find interesting is that the criticism, or at least I would say this is criticism that comes from someone who knows something about that industry, is coming from a former New York Times journalist, so who now owns, is a part owner of several nail salons in New York City.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So the criticism comes from a former New York Times reporter. He and his wife, and I think a sister, own two salons. That he wrote a piece last week in the New York Review of Books, and he called the Times investigation into question. He says that especially the Times claim that there were several ads in two Chinese language newspapers advertising for nail salon jobs at $10 an hour. He said those are false. He said, or at least he couldn't find them when going through the papers before the Times did their story, during the time that they were reporting the story, and after the time. And he points out that he and his wife and sister-in-law all speak Chinese and read it. Well, the Times executive editor, Dean Becquet, as well as the line editors for that story, wrote a very muscular defense that came out yesterday. And basically what they said was the former reporter and current salon owner, you know, might be right to say that his employees are treated well, but that they have hundreds of hours of work that they did. They interviewed more than 100 people. They had access to government documents. And they say that what they found was what they reported, that basically, in general, this is a problem industry where especially people who are apprentices in the nail salon business, who tend to come from Asia, many of them illegal immigrants, are being paid $10 an hour, or maybe even having to pay a fee themselves just to get the training, and that they have horrible working conditions. So what did you make, Stacy, of the defense?
This one, if you compare it to the Clinton email story, which was relatively easy to figure out where it went wrong, this one is a lot tougher, because as you read that Times defense, it looked to me like the problem that the Times had was not a shortage of reporting, but maybe a little over-editing. For instance, about the newspaper ads for the low-paid jobs, the critic said he couldn't find them. And then in the rebuttal, the Times said, well, here they were. And it was on this date and this date. So why didn't that end up in the original story? So it was a long story as it was. And maybe they thought, well, we don't need those details. But now the lack of details comes back to bite them.
Yeah, I think it was the lack of details. And I also think it was the choice of words. I mean, it was some of the words were overgeneralized about the extent of what was going on there. And it's kind of hard to dial that back when you have the overgeneralization without the specification that Stacy's talking about.
Well, and it's interesting because it kind of reads a little peevish if you read this defense, and you can, who can blame them after the week they had with the other story? But they came out, basically, these top editors of the New York Times, and they said that the Review of Books, not just the former reporter, but the Review of Books for publishing that piece was basically publishing industry advocacy and not unbiased journalism. Okay, peevish, but is that a fair response?
I think it's a fair response. The gentleman who raised the complaint wouldn't have done so if he didn't own some of these salons. And he says, of course, he owns the good ones. And, you know, maybe there are other ones. And I'm sure the Times is doing some extra reporting on his salon to see if that holds up.
Yeah, I have no doubt that there are good salons out there and that are doing a good job. And their customers and their workers swear by them. But I think the overall story, which we did talk about and I read, the overall story does point to some issues and some huge problems within that industry that I think need to be dealt with.
Before we leave this, I want to come back at least partway to a point that you raised, Stacey, about maybe there was too much editing of this story. There's an interesting article that we've posted on our Links blog, and it's written by a media critic, Felix Salmon, and he uses this nail salon controversy to make what he thinks is a bigger point about sort of replicating investigative journalism. He says that there are lots of aggregators out there, lots of people who want to copy investigative reporting, lots of people who want to explain or analyze that stuff. But he says that very few news organizations are ever willing to commit the resources to do their own original reporting on those same stories once somebody else beats them to the punch. And he blames that in part on what he says is a lack of transparency in our own reporting methods. So if I did the original story, I'm not telling you how I got the story and what my sources are, so that makes it hard for you to replicate it even if you want to. What do you think?
No, I think he brings up a very good point. And those of us in journalism and those of us who teach journalism, we sort of want to hold on to our sources. We don't hold on to the secrets of how we get what we get because we don't want the competition to figure that out, because if they figured it out, then they would have the sources and they would have the tricks of the trade, and that may hurt us from a news producing standpoint as well as a competitive financial standpoint. So I do think that he raises some very good points.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen that again on the television side for a long time, that the audience sees so little difference between the channels that they have to choose from that the only way to differentiate yourself are your investigations, your enterprise reporting. And so you want to cling to what you do and not share it across the board.
Well, talking of television, all eyes, well, no, not all eyes, set many eyes will be a week from tomorrow on Fox News Channel, because they're going to be airing the first of what will be several GOP primary debates. This one's going to be in Cleveland, and there are 16 Republican candidates. Well, Fox decided this week to change the rules just a little bit. They said that all of the contestants now are going to get to participate in a debate. 10 of them are going to be on in prime time, and those 10 are going to be determined by how well they're doing in an average of public opinion polls leading up to that debate. But the other 6 are also going to all get on, except at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Missouri time. And I just wonder, I mean, 16 candidates, there's got to be some way to winnow that down. You can't have 16 people on a stage and say anything substantive in 90 minutes, but is this the right approach to trying to figure out how we choose who gets to be on which stage?
No, I'm chomping at the mic here to get in on, to answer that. No, it's a horrible approach. 10 is horrible. 16 is worse. It's if they go with the 10 in the primetime one and you start to take out commercial time, introductions, things like that, each candidate is probably going to have 4 minutes of airtime. And so what do you do if you have 4 minutes? You try to stunt. Well, they'll be trying to top Donald Trump the whole time, most likely. So it will be a lot of stunts. We've seen stunts to try to make the top 10, Lindsey Graham destroying his cell phone and other things like that. So it's a horrible thing. If you wanted to do it, Fox, and do it right, do it over 4 nights, have 4 candidates a night, and let America, not everybody will tune into all of them, but give them time to do it in maybe 4 at a time or something like that.
No, I think Stacey's absolutely right. I mean, and part of the problem they're going to have is that you're also, I mean, they're saying you only have 4 minutes. Well, we know they're going to take more than that. So you're going to have these candidates talking over each other. So you're not only going to have the stunts, you're also going to have people who aren't going to adhere to the time limits. And that just makes it, that's just going to make it a complete circus, I think, when you get down to it.
You know, I mean, I do agree with you, but I would also say that it wouldn't matter if there were 5 candidates or 2 candidates on the stage. The way we do modern broadcast debates, they're going to stunt no matter what. They're going to talk in sound bites. There's a whole kabuki theater aspect to this thing, and they're not really going to debate.
Yeah, they're not going to debate. They're going to stick to whatever points they want to make. But I think you're going to have an audience for this mainly because of Trump. People are going to tune in just to hear what outlandish thing he's going to say. And then you're going to have the other candidates trying to either debunk him or one-up him. You know, and that's what is going to create, I think, the circus that we're likely to see next week.
If I can defend it at all, I at least appreciate the idea of trying to put a lot of candidates out there for people to see. Right now, if you want to find out a lot about one of the Republican or one of the Democratic candidates who's not Hillary Clinton, you have to put some work into it. And you can go online and find it. But a lot of voters don't spend a lot of time seeking out what they, particularly this far before the election, seeking out information online. So it will at least expose people to some candidates they might not know much about.
Let's say a little bit more about Trump, as much as I prefer not to. But we got a bit more proof this week that the news media are at least partially responsible for Trump's sudden popularity. There was a consultant, Andrew Tyndall. I think we've seen his reports in the past. He basically counts media minutes on TV for a living. And he measured how much airtime the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates got on the three big TV networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, over the past 7 weeks. And what he found was is that Donald Trump got four times the minutes of Jeb Bush and 12 times the minutes of Hillary Clinton. Can we defend that?
I don't.
No. Not well. It depends on what we see our role as. If we see our role as providing information to voters to help sustain a healthy democracy, no, we can't support it at all. If we lump it into the news of the day and what people are talking about, then it's defensible to a point.
I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, it gets eyeballs on television. It clicks on the computer screen. You're going to draw the audience. And I think that's, you know, that's why you see the numbers the way you see them.
You mentioned one possibility, basically having four at a time spread out over several nights. And there was a variant of that that was proposed by a columnist we've got up on our blog. He basically says, take it as two nights, so a mini series, I guess, maybe, and divide them equally and basically draw lots to see who gets to be on the stage with whom. At least statistically, nobody has an advantage over anybody else. Would that make a difference? And would people be more likely to watch or less likely to watch if you had a surprise as to who's debating whom?
Maybe a little more likely. Again, I think it comes back, and again, being involved with televised debates over the years, I always ran into objections from some of our partners who didn't want to include the Libertarian candidate or, right, or Green Party. And I'm like, well, this is our chance to let the public see everybody. And so I'm in support of that. Even people that you look at and say, he or she has no chance of winning. Well, they have to start someplace.
Yeah, I can see, Ernest, by the way, why Fox News and CNN, which is using a similar approach whenever they do their debate, of, you know, given the current circumstances and environment and restrictions, let's use polls. But the problem is with so many candidates now, with a, as you know, with a public opinion survey, if they're going to average together those surveys, in many instances, they're only interviewing a few hundred people. And so the margin of error is going to swamp those folks at the bottom. So it's a guessing game who's really in the top 10.
And you're absolutely right. It is a guessing game. And I think everyone who's not getting that TV time, who's not getting that air time, they're left in the lurch. I mean, you've got Chris Christie, you've got Rick Perry, you've got Carly Fiorina. They're all jockeying and worrying, okay, how can I make the biggest splash now to get my name in the poll so that I can get in the debate? And so using polls is not really fair to those candidates.
Well, and they're national polls, and if we want to look at the mechanics of this, they really ought to just be using Iowa and New Hampshire polls, because
if you don't get
past those two states, you're not going to go any farther, so you ought to at least look at who's got a shot in those states.
I mean, in some ways, you could ask, why does it really matter? I mean, candidates who did poorly in early polls last time, some of them made big gains later in the primaries. We can think about Newt Gingrich, for example, some of them who did really well. Remember Michelle Bachmann and the Atlanta pizza guy? Well, they fell out of the race, even though they were way up in the polls for a while.
I mean, Mitt Romney didn't even participate in the first one.
So from a public perspective, I guess you could say, who cares? Why does it matter?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's going to matter because, you know, you've got these names making splashes right now, and it's going to matter to them. It matters to the candidate. It matters to the party.
Well, it matters.
It should matter to the public, but who knows?
It matters to Fox, because Fox wants to be its own primary in that sense. It wants to join Iowa and New Hampshire in terms of helping pick who the candidate is here.
And I guess if you believe yourself to be a legitimate candidate, the money could dry up for you before you have a chance to make your case if you don't get on the debate. So we'll see. Well, there were some other numbers, really depressing numbers, that came out this past couple of weeks regarding jobs in American newsrooms. The American Society of News Editors released its annual survey of newspaper employment this week. And What it found was a double-digit drop from 2013 to 2014. Almost 4,000 jobs are gone, and we're almost down to half the number of newspaper journalists who were there in the high point of 1990. So, Ernest, it's kind of hard to see any silver lining in those numbers.
No, there's not a lot of silver lining. I mean, if you go back and you look at the numbers, if you're a journalist and you're trying to get to a large newspaper, if you're talking about the 250 and above, they're doing some hiring. If you're talking about the smaller markets, which you're talking about below 100,000, then they have some jobs, so you've got some opportunity there. But if you're talking about a Des Moines Register or Dallas Morning News or Houston Chronicle or those kinds of papers, they're the ones that are shedding jobs at a tremendous rate. And I think what we're seeing is not the beginning stage, but maybe even the middle stage of having the small dailies in the small area, and then you're going to have large national newspapers, and you're not going to have those regional newspapers.
Stacy, there's one other aspect of these surveys that we look at, whether they come from AS&E or the recently released numbers from RTDNA that represents the broadcast journalists. The diversity numbers are just as depressing, though maybe not unexpected. I mean, it's, what, 20-plus years where basically there's been no statistically significant change in the number of minority reporters, editors, producers, managers in whether it's radio, TV, or newspapers. We're not going to solve that problem, you know, obviously in a few minutes, but it's something we need to talk about.
Yeah, the editor numbers are the most troubling as you look at those, because maybe we've reached the point of minority saturation. I think it's a pay issue more than anything else. People aren't considering this as a career. But the excuse 15, 20 years ago, and I've been involved with that survey for RTDNA all those years, is, oh, well, we'll have more minority managers. They're just new to the field, and they have to mature in the thing. Well, that hasn't come to pass. They have not become managers. Women have. We've seen the number of women managers, particularly in broadcast, start to even up, and there, we may be at a point where we have more female news directors than male, but the minority numbers have not come up over all those years, and so there's either an internal problem with promotion, despite what people say, or minorities are leaving the news business before they get to that managerial spot.
And I think we were still hearing that same argument where we can't find qualified minority candidates for these jobs. Well, on our links blog, we have a story that was done by a PhD student at the Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania that clearly shows that there are candidates out there. They just aren't being hired. They're not being hired at the same rate as white candidates coming out of journalism programs across the country. So that argument has not held water for a long time, and it's still not holding water. So I think it just boils down to you have managers out there who are going to hire their friends, or they're going to hire someone that they feel is more qualified, and more than likely that candidate is going to be one.
Yeah. I don't know if we might as well give up on legacy media, but I wonder if the gains we're going to see in actual diversity of news coverage is going to come more from non-traditional sources than from TV and newspapers.
It may, and they may not be showing up in these surveys, because the surveys have sampled the same group for many years, decades in some cases, and so they may not be expanding the universe for the poll that we've seen in the others.
What's your impression of
that? Yeah, I think it goes back to we do need to expand it. I mean, the media is expanding, and I think we're going to have to maybe move away from the legacy media to see whether or not it's playing out in a larger area, because I do think that in specific areas of African American, Hispanic, and Asian, especially online, that's growing, and I think that's where those numbers are.
Obviously, we're going to have to revisit this topic many more times, but that's all the time that we have for today and for this week. I want to thank you all for listening. You can find background to our stories on kbia.org. Just click on Views of the News under the Programs menu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Views on KBIA or on Facebook at Views of the News. Download our weekly podcast if you like on iTunes, and you can listen to us anytime that you like. Thanks to Ernest and Stacy for joining me this week, and thanks also to our audio engineer, KBIA's Pat Akers. I'm Mike McKean. We're off next week, but join Amy Simons, Ernest Perry, and me on Wednesday, August 12th, for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.